On this episode of China Unscripted, we talk with a former Chinese Communist Party official turned democracy activist about his meeting with Vice President Mike Pence, how Xi Jinping faces enemies everywhere, and the future of China after the Communist Party is over. Hi, welcome to China Unscripted. I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Ganesda.
Joining us today is Dr. Yang Jianli, a former Tiananmen Square activist. He has a PhD in mathematics from UC Berkeley and a PhD in political economics from Harvard. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So after you went back to China in 2002 to help labor activists, you were arrested and sentenced to 5 years in prison. After your release, you founded Citizen Power Initiatives for China, a group that advocates for the peaceful transition to democracy in China. So tell us about the peaceful transition to democracy in China. How can that be achieved?
I think we need the people's power. We need everybody be empowered with the idea of human rights, democracy, and freedom. And we also need the people on ground to come together to engage in peaceful efforts to try to change China and peacefully. And we believe in nonviolence. And also, we need international support. But we haven't seen many, many protests in China, but we still need a viable opposition movement in China, which is something we are working on. And yes, international support is also very important for China to go to democracy.
So I have a question about that. China, the Chinese Communist Party, is one of the most brutal authoritarian dictatorships in the world. How can nonviolent strategies affect change in that environment?
Yep. No matter what means you want to employ, you will find, the cause is very, very difficult to achieve anything under this very, very brutal and cunning dictatorship. But according to a lot of historical experiences, nonviolent protests have a higher probability to achieve our goals. Remember, Chinese government is the most powerful in military and in economics on earth. So if we engage in violent action against it, we can only play into its hands. You know, we just use the weakest to do anything against the strongest. This is not wise. But in China, we haven't seen, as I just said, many, many protests. There are very, very, very few actually succeeded. It's not for the purpose of overall change China, but for, you know, the very local economic interest-driven issue, some such as environmental protection issue. And only the few, very few actually succeeded. They are all nonviolent. None of the violent protests actually have ever succeeded in China. So I believe in violence. It takes time. It also takes a determination and a discipline to engage in violent resistance.
You mean nonviolent resistance?
Nonviolence, yeah.
Okay. So what would a nonviolent tactic look like? Because as you said, there's not many protests happening in China.
Yeah, well, now it's not many protesting. Protests are happening in China because Xi Jinping has, tightened up the control over civil society. But there's still space if you really want to do something. You know, when we talk about nonviolent actions or movement, we have to make a distinction between individual action and protest and the whole movement demanding for overall change. For, you know, different levels of actions and purpose have different tactics. For individual actions, actually everybody can do something. For example, they can get around a firewall to get information overseas and disseminate among the people.
Like episodes,
you know,
of China
as a
Uncensored.
Teacher, yeah, they censor, but still can find a way to get information to many, many people. That's an individual action. The individual actions, including a teacher, can send something in the classroom. Of course, the teacher would risk being arrested, harassed, and any losing job, something like that. But there's still some space. If people can engage in individual actions to a certain degree, if this is an individual action. And then next level would be protest for a single issue purpose. For example, in environmental protection. So they have to be very careful how to formulate their slogan and come together to win even the people in the government to their side. Then next level would be the movement, peaceful movement, demanding for overall change. You know, that takes a lot to actually for people to come together.
So is this what the citizen power is in Citizen Power Initiative?
Yes, that's what we try to do. We committed to empower the people back in China in whatever way possible to help them to engage in peaceful action to defend their own rights or demand for political change in China.
So you had mentioned the three levels, the one of being individual action, and the second being like individual, like specific protests, and the third being like a broader movement. Where is China right now?
China, we used to have a lot of protests for one issue. It's not for overall change demanding. That was before Xi Jinping came to power. But after Xi Jinping took power, the space has been increasingly squeezed. Now it's almost zero. So now we are in, you know, we can describe the China situation as they only have a space for individual actions. Even that is very it's very dangerous.
There's this perception that Chinese people, they won't care about things like, you know, individual freedoms or democracy or, you know, civil society issues if they personally can, you know, have prosperity and things like that. What do you think of that?
It's not true. No matter how prosperous the individual is, whether it's poor or rich, in the end, people are demanding for freedom. If you become rich, then you have more resources at your disposal in the society. Then you want to have more say in the political decision-making process, locally or nationally. So naturally, I think they will demand for more political rights. If you are happen to be at the bottom of society, of course, you want more share economically. And oftentimes, you will find, you know, the unfair system is based on unfair political system. So you want to do something about it. So I think it's not about whether people desire for more political right. It is the question whether the government allow them to. You know, the government now has been clamping down on their civil society, and anybody or everybody who want to do anything, even, you know, put out a message online, would put them in the very, very dangerous situation. You know, given this kind of political coercion, we can only imagine it's so difficult for people to take action. And, you know, international media and a lot of observers always talk about, you know, how much the Chinese people want freedom or democracy or human rights. The, you know, the information they look at is the discourse online. But we cannot forget only the, ideas, opinions allowed by the government can be freely expressed online. So it's very biased. We cannot take that as a reality. So I think the problem is on the government, is not on the people. As a matter of fact, in the past 30 years of the Tiananmen massacre, the concept of a human rights and democracy and freedom, rule of law, is, you know, all these perfect concepts are prevailing in people's mind. And if given any space, discourse space, they will express it. You know, I engage with the petitioners in China all the time. Oftentimes, I try to minimize talking about these abstract concepts because I was afraid, you know, I might get them to the situation where they don't know what we're talking about. But, you know, it is them. Most time, it is them. Actually, they told us we have to demand for more political rights because they understand without the political rights, you know, the economic system is unfair. So what I try to say, desire for freedom is no problem. The problem is how much the government wants you to do it.
Right. So what you're saying is that what Chinese people are saying online is a very limited and highly censored version of what people in that country are actually feeling. So how do you suss out what people are actually feeling and what the situation is like on the ground?
Yes, we are engaging people on the ground all the time, and we know what they demand, number one. Number two, you know, there are some times when, you know, freedom it was greater. You know, there's always a time freedom is greater than other times. When there is a space, you will see a lot of people talking about the rights, talking about democracy, talking about local government corruption, or, you know, all these kind of things.
Right. And in what kind of space are you observing this now?
Now we are have WeChat. WeChat is highly censored. We know that. But, you know, there's always tactics to put your the message there. The message may just leave for a few hours, sometimes as short as a few minutes, but still the message spread so fast. Every day when you get on the social media like WeChat, we see lots of expressions like that. And Twitter is another thing. Of course, normal people in China cannot use Twitter, but those who are savvy enough to get around firewall and use this technology can use Twitter. Myself, I have 135,000 followers. Most of them are in China. So there are a lot of discussions and communications through those social media.
So you think there could be much more discontent in China than people can tell from on the surface?
Oh, yes, of course.
So how does that go from being this underground movement to actually being something that can affect regime change?
Yeah, that's a very, very difficult question. And for a dictatorship to change to democracy, it usually takes a few factors, few conditions to come together. Number one, the general existing robust discontent with the government. That is existing in China. The regime does not lack enemies. We see lot of them. Not only the independent scholars in China, dissidents, human rights activists, petitioners, Falun Gong practitioners, Uyghurs, now Hong Kongers, you name it. So many of them. So we have so many people in China who loathe this current system and want change. The second factor is the viable opposition. The most difficult part is to translate the people's demand into a viable democracy opposition movement. We have been working for so many years for that. So far, we have not succeeded. And there are a lot of reasons. Now I don't think I will get into it. The third condition is that the cracks in the leadership of the regime. And of course, the third condition and the second one are mutually reinforcing. Because if we have a viable opposition, it will be more likely there is cracks in the government. If there is a cracks in the government, then more likely then we'll have a viable opposition. And the fourth condition is international recognition of the viable democracy movement and come to its support at a very important moment. So we need actually these are four conditions to come together. But quite unfortunately, after Tiananmen Square, the collapse of the Soviet Union has never been far away from the mind of the communist leaders. So ever since then, they have been doing everything possible to control society. They put a lot of resources on the front line, which is preventing people from coming together, the protest. Mm-hmm. If we have 10,000 people in Tiananmen Square at this moment, this regime will be toppled. But we understand it. The regime understands it better. So they are trying to prevent that thing from happening. So because of that, because of the government's tactics and all the measures they have been using, the resources they have been put into the so-called stability-preserving system, our movement is still, after so many years, at a very, very primitive stage of not yet become a viable movement. So that's quite unfortunately.
In top-tier cities like Beijing and Shanghai now, there are surveillance cameras everywhere.
Everywhere, yeah.
With face recognition and so on. Are these effective tools in preventing people from coming out to protest before
effective.
They come out?
Very effective. Not only in the first tier cities like Beijing and Shanghai, actually everywhere in China, even in the countryside, my hometown, that is Shandong province. In the village, I talk to my hometown fellows all the time. They have told me that in every village, there are 5 to 20, for example, cameras in the small village to watch people. And in every classroom on university campus, there are a couple of cameras. So so it's very difficult, if not totally impossible, for people to come together to form some kind of, to build some kind of momentum for protest. If people only live online, to expressing these ideas, this content. Yes, which is very important, but still we cannot effect a very, very important change. We need people to go to street, to come together. But the regime is so good at controlling that.
From what you're saying, it sounds like the situation is pretty hopeless.
Right. So it's very difficult. But I think one hope is Xi Jinping not only alienate dissident further as his predecessors did, but he alienate so many of his comrades in the party. There are potentially a lot of cracks. And he understands that there are a lot of enemies around him, but he does not even know where, from which direction the first attack would take place. So he, of course, he's so powerful, but his situation is precarious. And I think with international pressure, with Hong Kong's demonstration, with Chinese economic downturn and potential financial crisis, there's a common opportunity for people to come together to form a viable opposition against the Xi first, against the Xi Jinping first. I think that is very, very likely this year or next year, in a couple of years to come. Reason being, Xi Jinping made himself himself president for life. He amended the constitution. He removed the term limit last year. That actually a turning point that triggered a lot of opposition, covert opposition within the party. And in 2 years to come, Xi Jinping will do everything possible to make sure he will enter the third term successfully. But we can only imagine there's so many resistance. Because if he succeeded, he would not share power with his comrades in the same generation. He would also leave no opportunity for next generation. And give in the past few years, the so-called anti-corruption campaign orchestrated and led by him alienated so many political elite and economic elite in the party. So I think the resistance will be very, very strong. And any common opportunity, economic crisis, for example, if Hong Kong demonstration lasts long enough, I think there are going to be some kind of opportunity for people to come together to form a viable opposition against the Xi. Once there is a big crack in the party, then the society will react in its own way. So I see the hope in this. Another hope is,
So before we get into that, I have a question. We've talked before on the show about how there's a factional power struggle between Xi Jinping and the former leader Jiang Zemin.
Yeah.
Are there more people that are there more factions than just that, or more groups of people, or is it more divided than that? You know, could we see people who have been loyal to Xi Jinping in the past, like Li Keqiang or Wang Yang, in the Politburo Standing Committee, start to, have these differences of opinion with Xi Jinping that become problematic for him?
Right. And I don't see a visible faction in the party, but I can only imagine there are so many individuals on top level who want to see him fail. And take Hong Kong, for example. After the Hong Kongers took to streets in early June, I have been talking to my friends back in Beijing. I want to understand how these leaders on top, each of them, react to Hong Kong, the situation. And all the information I have got so far points to the fact that everybody's weak, with all the evils will be brought to the feet of Xi Jinping. That means everybody's that you own everything, you own power, so you own the problem. When there's a crisis like Hong Kong, we just wait. It's not our responsibility. And everybody wished this evil will be brought to Xi Jinping, and it will spell his down. And so that's the major mentality in Beijing. And economic issue is another one. The trade issue is another one. Everybody's just waiting, sitting there without doing anything. Let him to take care. And they want every crisis to spell a failure to him. So that's the mentality. I don't see clearly see factions, but so many individuals. So again, back to the original point that we meet, it takes an opportunity for them to come together. And Xi Jinping himself doesn't even know who will attack him first, from which direction. But there's so many enemies in party, out of party, in the society, in Hong Kong, in Tibet, in Xinjiang, international community, everywhere. And we need opportunity. So when U.S. has an economic war with China, I think that's very, very good opportunity for us, because the economic issue is very important for Xi Jinping. If we can hold economy together, and he still can survive, if there is a major economic crisis, I think that will serve as opportunity for his enemies to come together.
So kind of what you're saying is, even though the crimes of the Chinese Communist Party extend way beyond Xi Jinping himself, he may ultimately get the blame for everything.
Yes.
So earlier you talked about four factors that can lead to nonviolent regime change, and it seems like many of those factors are happening right now in Hong Kong. You've already kind of mentioned it, but how does Hong Kong play into all of this?
Hong Kong is very, very important, not only for Hong Kong itself, but for the entire country of China. And we all watching. Hong Kong is the only place under Xi Jinping's rule still have a space for this kind of demonstrations. And Hong Kong people have been doing very, very well, very brief, very wise, and largely peaceful. And but there, if there's no Beijing, if no Beijing factor, I think Hong Kong already different, or totally different thing. And the Hong Kong government will give it some concessions, will engage a real dialogue with the protesters. But the recent news by major international media revealed that Carrie Lam, the chief executive, expressed her willing to resign and regret and all of the things. But it's this Beijing that who does not want her to give any confession. So Beijing is still the major factor for the for the outcome of the protest in Hong Kong. And my prediction is Xi Jinping will do everything possible to control the situation before October 1st, the 70th National Day of PRC. On this day, he will have a massive military parade reviewing. The government has already announced it would be the largest in many decades. He wants to use this opportunity to show a prosperous, harmonious, and a strong China under his leadership. And he wants to use this ceremony to reinforce his position as an authority unchallenged by anyone, everyone in the party, in the country, or international community. But Hong Kong people understand very well, so they would not miss this opportunity to focus international spotlight on Hong Kong issue and also to apply pressure on Xi Jinping. So Xi Jinping would do everything possible to take over. And as I described earlier, next 2 years will be very, very important for Xi Jinping. It's so important. It's very decisive for him whether he will be successfully enter the third term, then become a king. And I can imagine every of his enemy in the party, in the society, or even in the international community has extended arm politically and economically in Hong Kong. That means if there's a space for political actions, open political actions, in the years to come, we'll see lot of them. Xi Jinping, from his point of view, he would not want Hong Kong to be a base for opposition against him. So for these reasons, I think he would do everything possible to close down the space for any free political expression in Hong Kong.
So what you're saying is basically that Hong Kong will no longer be one country, two systems by October 1st.
Yeah. You know, Hong Kong is multiplayer game. I just talked about one player's intention and his tactics. The outcome, the final outcome, will not be dominated by any single player, will not be what a single player or if he or her wanted. As far as I have found, the Hong Kong people are so determined. They will not give up. And just yesterday, some news revealed that Carrie Lam's position actually is wavering. It's not as strong as people would think at first. So there's some cracks there. So if we have strong enough international support and the strategies that the Hong Kongers are using are right, I think we still have very good chance to win. That means in the end, the Hong Kong government will give concession. I think if we succeed in that way, that would be a major victory for the democracy movement for the entire country.
For the entire country, all of China.
Yeah, all China, yeah.
So speaking of international pressure, recently you met with Vice President Mike Pence. What did you discuss?
We discussed the religious freedom issue. But of course, during the meeting, Vice President Pence expressed his strong position for human rights in China overall, not only the religious freedom. And he also told us President Trump is also very on the issue, and he wants to make sure we understand the U.S. government and the people of American people are behind us. But, you know, as human rights activists, we think the U.S. have a lot more to do. Magnitsky Act, for example, has not been fully implemented. So we still want the U.S. government to do more, and they should do more. But we really appreciate their open support for Hong Kong and for the human rights in China and for, you know, everything they have done in the past and continue to do.
Do you get the sense that the U.S. government is now willing to do more about China than they were before?
I think they are willing to do more than a few years ago. And with the trade conflict going on, I think it's a long, will be long-term conflict. I don't think they can reach any meaningful agreement anytime soon. So this kind of conflict will spill over to other fields, such as security and value. And we believe the root cause for all this conflict is the conflict of value. That means if you don't care about the nature of the Chinese government, no matter what you negotiate with this regime, in the end, you will see the problems recur. You will do it again and again until, to the point, maybe it's too late. With this conflict, I think the human rights issue will be elevated. Actually, it is elevated, has been elevated in the past 2 years. And we want this trend to continue. And as I said earlier, the U.S. government can do more. When they talk about economic issue, they should link that with a human rights issue. Go ahead.
When you were meeting with Vice President Pence, did you get the sense that the concerns for human rights were his own personal values, or that this was something broader from the entire Trump administration or U.S. government?
I think he, of course, Vice President himself is a human rights person. He's so strong in the universal value and has been very, very outspoken about human rights in China, around the world, which I really appreciate it. And I have a very strong sense it is not only about himself. It is about U.S. government and the Congress. And we have been working very closely with quite a few congressional leaders, and not only for the human rights issue, but also for treaty issue, for example. I think some congressional leaders from the other side of aisle, Democrats, even stronger than the White House when it comes to China. So I don't think it is one individual issue. I mean, it's not a one person's issue. It's not about president or vice president or White House or this administration or just a few members of Congress. I think it's about the entire trend of U.S.-China policy.
So what do you think are some specific things the U.S. government could do in Hong Kong or China at large, considering the fact that the Chinese Communist Party often pushes the propaganda that, like, the protest movement in Hong Kong isn't real, it's manufactured by the black hands of the U.S. government?
Right. First of all, the Hong Kong protests are homegrown. We all know that. But the Chinese government tried to smear that so that they can easily mobilize the national sentiment home. To prepare for, you know, any heavy-handed crackdown in Hong Kong. But still, I think a lot of countries have an interest in Hong Kong. Even for that, they have to support Hong Kong's protest to make sure Beijing will not bring the protest to a bloody end. So the voice should be stronger. But there are a lot of specific things the U.S. can do. I mentioned the Magnitsky Act. So they should be prepared to put on the sanction list of officials both in Beijing and Hong Kong who are responsible for the escalating Hong Kong situation, tense and a police violence or possible a bloody crackdown in Hong Kong. And Hong Kong now is a special tariff region. The U.S., there's a bill already introduced, which is called the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act. I think Congress should pass that as soon as possible. And for trade, I think trade should link with Hong Kong. And Chinese government is eager to reach a trade agreement with the U.S. Because the economic downturn every minute can bring about an opportunity for oppositions to come together. And that's the major issue actually Xi Jinping cares very much, cares most. And if U.S. take a very, very strong position on trade and link that with the human rights situation in Hong Kong and China, I think that will play a very, very important, very critical role in the what we will have in the end.
So it's interesting, after everything you said today, that you were once a Communist Party official yourself in China. So how did you go from that to being a democracy activist?
I joined the party in the early 80s, largely answering Hu Yaobang's call. Hu Yaobang was the open-minded leader, party chief of that time. He called young intellectuals like myself to join the party, to change the party from within. And I believed in that and enticed to join the party, trying to change the system from within. Very soon, I found it is the opposite way was working. And it is not we that changed the party. It was the party that changed us. And I found my daily job watching my fellow students and teachers and try to help. I had to help the government to control them. So I was disbanded and left the country to come to the United States to study. And 3 years after that, the student movement began in Beijing, and I went back. And I joined the movement. I witnessed the massacre and narrowly escaped and survived the massacre and returned to the United States. So ever since then, I have been committed myself to doing everything possible to change China peacefully. So that's how it happened.
Now, Dr. Yang, there's something interesting that you do that I feel like I don't see a lot of other, Chinese human rights activists doing, and that's kind of bringing all these different groups together. Like, you run an interfaith conference for ethnic and religious minorities in China. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. And after Tiananmen Square, we formed a think tank trying to design for future China. If we don't want this kind of government, what kind of government we want? What kind of political system we want? We want to answer this question. So we organized a lot of scholars to study for future of China, and we came up with the constitution, which is a federation with different degrees of autonomy. I didn't until then realize we have to engage in dialogue with other ethnic groups So, you know, before that, I had never had any chance to have any kind of interaction with them. The Tibetans, the Uyghurs, Mongolians, and the people in Hong Kong and people in Taiwan, those directly involved with China have a high stake in the future of China. So we found the need to dialogue with them. The first group we approached was Tibetans and the Dalai Lama himself. I personally organized quite a few dialogues between Chinese and the Tibetans. The Dalai Lama himself involved, and he had one dialogue with 400 Chinese scholars in Boston. So I was encouraged by this development, and in the year 1998 or 1999, I thought I would expand the dialogues, include other groups into this forum, and so I launched the Inter-Ethnic Interfaith Leadership Conference. This conference seeks to bring the younger generation leaders from Chinese majority Han, Tibetans, Uyghurs, Mongolians, and religious groups of Christians, of Falun Gong practitioners, and a regional group, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Macau. And it soon became an annual event. At the very beginning, there was a lot of resentment and misunderstanding, mistrust, mainly, other groups versus the Chinese Han majority. And over years, we resolved a lot of differences and come to the understanding that we have to work together. And now there's no problem for us to come together. Not like when we first started, we have to talk about the issue from 2,000 years ago, 5 years ago. Now we just naturally come together to come to each other's support. And by doing so, of course, we risk being labeled as separatists. I recently was called out by Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs in its document to the international media. And they smeared me as a separatist and a violent riot leader and a spy. And bring these people who try to divide China together every year, things like that. But you know how important this platform for all of us. And I think because we all believe in human rights. And now we just don't worry about after China become a democratic, whether Tibet would be part of China or not, for example, as we used to worry so much. Now, I don't think that's the issue we worry about. We worry about everybody's human rights situation. And we don't have a predetermined position whether Taiwan would be part of China in the future or not. But we come together to care for their well-being. And because we all have a high stake in the future of China. So we all understand the Chinese communist regime is our common enemy. We have to work on it. And so I think it's so important. For example, when Hongkongers took to the street, those people actually we are in constant communication, try to find a way to help. The Tibetans, Uyghurs, all come together. So now it's become so natural for people to come together. It's very important and a positive development.
Well, I can see why the Communist Party fears you. I mean, 100 years ago, Sun Yat-sen was, you know, educated in the West and spent time in the United States and was able to organize a resistance movement to take down the corrupt Qing dynasty.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that historical precedent is what the Communist Party is looking at now with this, you know, with your overseas group as a potential very significant threat to their stability.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to ask if you thought, we were talking earlier about the viable opposition, needing a viable opposition to the current regime. Is that what you're building here?
Yeah, we try to build it from overseas, and that will eventually get back to China. And that's what we are building. You're right.
You're basically planning the future government of China when the Chinese Communist Party falls.
Yes, we do some kind of research on that issue. And also we have one concept that is substitute, how to say it, substitute government people. So we have to prepare people who will take over. But, you know, it's very difficult. We have a very limited resources. And the government with so big economic power, they go everywhere to corrupt. Even in this country, sometimes I find it very difficult to work with academic institutions, for example. And so we always have an uphill battle to fight.
Have you found that the Communist Party's United Front Work Department has tried to infiltrate your organization or interfere with you?
Everywhere. Yes. It happens almost every day, everywhere.
Like, what's an example?
Recently, there's a book published in Hong Kong, smearing myself. Making up stories.
Okay, congratulations, because it means you're doing something right.
Yeah, there's a lot of talks on Twitter about this book, and this is one example. Another, they apply tremendous pressure on my family members, which I normally do not want to talk about so much, and so my family is very divided. So it's very sad to say. And a lot of so-called friends come to talk to me almost every day, try to find the information, sometimes they try to volunteer to work in our organization, and they try to find out what the U.S. government tried to do through our organization. And just yesterday, a classmate of mine in junior high who has not been in contact for 40 years, 30 years, 30 more years, suddenly sent me a message from China. And openly trying to be in touch with me, and so friendly. Usually in China, if you don't have such a task from the government, you would be very careful to openly associate it with me. So I just give you some example, give you some kind of sense of how they work. And my family members in China, they apply more restrictions on them in recent months.
That sounds like you've got a big challenge on your plate.
Mm.
So something I'm asked a lot is, what can people listening who are maybe mostly Americans do to help affect a positive regime change in China?
Maybe regime change is the wrong word.
I think it's the right word. What word would you use?
Well, no, just because then it's the idea that the regime change can comes from, Americans
or
the CIA.
Want to,
yeah.
Well, people want to help the situation in China, but they don't know how. So how can Americans, how can somebody listening help?
Yes, this is a very, very good question. To answer your question, I have to say I'm so thankful. I'm so thankful for people of this country and for, you know, everything they have done. Without the United States, we don't even have a home now. And personally, you know, I owe my freedom, even my life, to this country. When I was in prison, so many people in this country helped. And I really, really appreciate it. I want American people to understand this. So many, many people around the world, especially the oppressed people, are looking to U.S. as a beacon of hope. And, you know, that said, I want to say there are a lot of things that American people can help Chinese to improve their human rights situation. Number one, this is democracy. So the beauty of democracy is the leaders of this country must hear your voice. So you have to make your voice louder to let your representative hear you about your concern about Hong Kong and China. And this is number one. Number two, you have to get right information about reality in China to begin with. And wherever you find yourself work, for example, if you're a professor at one of the university, you cannot use academic issue as an issue to block those voices, the voices from Chinese citizens. And another thing we can do is get information to publish. Published articles are so important. If you can publish articles about China to educate the American public about the real situation in China, how important China, not only for the people of China, but for the entire world. Help the American people understand the human rights issue in China. It has a lot to do with the well-being of the people here. I have a lot of examples to share how the Chinese government tried to change the democratic way of life here, how they corrupt the democratic way of life here. So actually affect the life here, and of course to link the human rights with the security issue, with the treaty issue. They are all related. You know, when people talk about trade deficit with China, many people may not understand that China's human rights deficit has contributed largely to the U.S. trade deficit with China. Because with that kind of system, the human rights low, all the costs for produce are very, very low, so that China is able to dump the cheap good in this country, and not let alone lot of products made by forced labor. Our organization just issued a report last week about forced labor in Xinjiang. Actually, it's happening everywhere in China. So I think a lot of people who understand China should throw their voice, through their publication to educate the general American public, and that in turn will affect or influence their leaders to make the right China policy.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Dr. Yang.
Thank you so much.
And, you know, you mentioned sharing information. You know, that's something we try very hard to do on our shows, China Uncensored, and this podcast, China Unscripted. So as for getting out truthful information about China, you know, to those listening, really sharing this content is a way to help spread information and education about China. Now, if somebody wanted to learn more about you and what you do, where can they follow you, Dr. Yang?
They can follow me through Twitter. My Twitter identity is at YangJianLi001. They also can check our website. That is citizenpowerforchina.org.
.org?
Yeah.
All right. Great. Definitely. Anyone listening, please check that out. And thanks for listening. Once again, I'm Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Ganesda.
Talk to you next time.